If there remained any lingering optimism that the world is too interconnected for large capitalist nations to go to war, February 24th, 2022 was the final nail in the coffin. The Russian invasion of Ukraine is far from the first armed conflict this century, nor is it even the first initiated by Russia. But in its scale and proximity to the European continent, it's perhaps the most symbolically significant. Clearly, the Golden Arches theory of history, which suggests no two countries home to a McDonald's franchise will fight one another, fails to capture the senseless violence some leaders are capable of inflicting. But although we aren't living in the end of history, neither could any simple economic model predict the scale or speed of the corporate exodus from Russia. The same companies which lend only lip service to climate change, many of which had not millions but billions invested in the country, simply packed up and left, and all in the span of a few weeks. When McDonald's announced its complete exit from the Russian market 81 days after the war began, we learned another important lesson. Not only is globalization not inevitable, but it can all unravel in an instant. And you can bet that if these largely self-imposed corporate sanctions surprised us, they absolutely shocked China, where everything is pure business. Everyone everywhere is now quietly wondering, if Russia, the world's 11th largest economy, could be effectively isolated overnight, could the same thing happen to China? Sponsored by CuriosityStream and Nebula, where you can watch the now-released third episode of my original series. This one is about China's dominance of rare earth elements, the essential ingredients for everything from smartphones to guided missiles. We talk about how China came to monopolize their production and whether or not the US should be worried. With the $15 a year CuriosityStream and Nebula bundle, you get access to the entire exclusive series, which is now an hour long and covers how Chinese censorship actually works, along with why it won't abandon COVID-0 anytime soon. If you enjoy these videos, sign up now to essentially get 50% more of them. China is not Russia. Placing the latter's $1.4 trillion GDP next to China's helps put things in perspective. The Russian economy is 10 times smaller. You could merge it, in fact, with the Korean, Brazilian, Australian, Spanish, Mexican, Canadian, Italian, and French economies, and it would still be smaller. Perhaps more importantly, Russia is insulated. Its largest export market is China, which buys 13% of its goods. And of its top 8 buyers, half could be characterized as, if not an ally, at least somewhat friendly. Just about 5% of its imports came from the United States, over 1/5 from China, and in third place is Belarus. Now, compare that with China's top export destinations. The first thing you'll notice is that a whole 1/6 goes to just one country, the US. And in reality, that number is likely much larger, because second place is Hong Kong, where many Chinese goods are re-exported abroad. Immediately below Hong Kong are non-NATO American allies Japan and South Korea, and slightly lower, NATO allies Germany, the Netherlands, and the UK. China, in other words, is much more dependent on America and her allies. But trade, in aggregate, is a very crude proxy for how much two countries depend on one another. For one, what is being traded matters a lot. To spell out the obvious, the current flow of goods is driven almost entirely by cost, and costs are based on the current circumstances. If those circumstances changed, most trade wouldn't disappear, it would simply be reorganized and rerouted. Take Australia, for example. The country produces a large quantity of iron, coal, and beef, of which China is by far its largest customer. In 2000, just 5% of Australian exports went to China. By 2020, that number had increased sixfold. So dependent on its northern neighbor is Australia that it has often been described, only partly humorously, as a Chinese satellite state. Clearly believing this narrative, China tried to bully what it perceived as small, easy prey in 2020 over what it called 14 grievances, which include Australia's call for an investigation into the origins of COVID-19. What followed was nothing short of a full-blown trade war. China imposed tariffs, duties, and bans, not to mention a state-organized boycott, of Australian imports. But Beijing overplayed its hand. While the trade disruption wasn't without costs, Australia turned around and found new buyers. First, China began looking for new sellers to replace Australia. Those turned out to be Russia and Indonesia. Russia and Indonesia previously supplied India, Japan, and South Korea, who were, likewise, now in need of a new supplier. As you can see here, their new supplier was Australia. Think of trade like a city's road network. Sure, you can block off one street, but traffic will simply find a new route. Any disruption will ripple throughout the city, causing some congestion, but a new equilibrium will eventually be found. Bans, tariffs, trade wars, and sanctions, therefore, aren't necessarily as catastrophic as they may seem. It all depends on what is being traded. Australia was selling iron, coal, and beef, high-demand commodities for which there are many possible buyers. Likewise, although oil, iron, soybeans, and copper are among China's largest imports by value, we can safely assume it will always have access to a seller. And not just because these are commodities. In the wake of US sanctions against Russia, many were surprised by the degree of international cooperation. Even historically neutral countries like Switzerland and Singapore proactively complied and publicly denounced the war. If China were to, say, seize and occupy an outlying Taiwanese island, it would prompt similar reflection from fence-sitters like Singapore. But getting everyone to cooperate with the toughest kind of sanctions against China would be a much more difficult challenge. Iron, soybeans, and oil would likely keep flowing from Brazil, for example. The country simply has too much to lose. If push came to shove, China could roll back some of its environmental regulations, allowing it to more easily source dirty commodities like coal domestically. The catch? Everything would be more expensive. A lot more expensive. No country has benefited more from the US Navy's guarding of the world's shipping lanes than China. If it were ever to withdraw that protection, China would enter a world of hurt. But that's the easy stuff. The real challenge would be advanced technology. You don't have to take my word for it either. China has assembled what is effectively a list of its own weaknesses, technologies and components it wants to be able to produce domestically. Despite investing many tens of billions of dollars into commercial airplane manufacturing, for example, China is almost entirely dependent on foreign imports. Its most commercially viable domestic plane, the C-919, still requires parts from GE, an American company. Tellingly, no one outside of China buys it. If the US ever applied maximum sanctions, Chinese commercial aviation would simply crash and burn, though its vast network of high-speed rail would somewhat soften the blow. At the very least, the industry would be forced to regress something like 40 years. But even this hypothetical bloodbath pales in comparison to semiconductors. There's a reason they receive so much airtime in discussions about China. The country buys a ton of them. In purely dollar terms, it imports as many semiconductors as it does crude oil. And that's saying a lot. China buys 1/4 of the entire world's oil by value. Even after investing $22 billion on a national semiconductor fund in 2014, and plenty more since, the truth is that China remains years behind. What it produces are almost exclusively low to medium-end chips. If cut off from imports, it'd still be able to make things like microwaves and televisions, but not iPhone 13s. It's not that China is behind and catching up. In terms of trade, it's behind and actively losing ground. Here you can see its semiconductor deficit not shrinking, but growing over time. And quite dramatically. 9 women can't make a baby in a month. And money alone can't instantly manifest an advanced semiconductor industry. Because China has been deliberately blocked from access to crucial ingredients like the Dutch lithography machines required to make the smallest chips, the only path forward entails billions of dollars of investment and many years of patience. According to one estimate, the country has a shortage of 300,000 semiconductor engineers. At the current rate of 30,000 new workers entering the industry each year, it would take at least 10 years to catch up to 2022 technology. And that's being optimistic. Now, in fairness, some number of semiconductors and other essential parts could fall off a truck, so to speak, and find their way to China, even with sanctions. Researchers, for instance, recently disassembled Russian weapons used in Ukraine only to discover American and European chips, engines, and other parts. Shell companies and intermediaries can covertly buy sanctioned parts. And given the state of consumer electronics today, enemy militaries can even source parts from products sold at Walmart. But the fact remains, China is deeply dependent on Western imports. Just look at the growing divide between what it says and what it actually does. Xi Jinping's first overseas trip as president was to Moscow. And on February 4th this year, just 20 days before the invasion of Ukraine, Putin was Xi's first in-person meeting with another head of state in over 2 years. Since then, China has refused to condemn the invasion or even refer to it as an invasion. Officially, it, quote, does not participate in sanctions against Russia. But the reality is, although it may do so very quietly, it does participate. No Chinese bank, no matter how patriotic, is willing to risk defying American sanctions. Likewise, in 2021, China passed an anti-sanctions law, which essentially makes it illegal for Chinese nationals to comply with American sanctions against China. Make no mistake, this law is driven not by supreme confidence, but rather deep-seated fear. If sanctions were nothing to worry about, it wouldn't be necessary. Its purpose is to increase the cost of sanctions, thereby, in theory, making them less likely. But this reluctance goes both ways. That divide between saying and doing is also quite large in America. Trade is, of course, a two-way street. Chinese imports mean dollars in the bank for American companies. Not to mention that many Chinese imports are then assembled into final products and shipped to the States. This is a list of companies on the S&P with the highest percentage of sales in China. With the sole exception of Wynn Resorts, which operates casinos in Macau, 9 of the top 10 are suppliers of semiconductors or other advanced technology components. Not far behind, with 1/4 of its revenue coming from China, is the second largest public company on Earth by market cap, Apple. If the American semiconductor industry were cut off completely from China, it would lose at least $80 billion and 125,000 jobs, according to the Commerce Department. Beyond lost sales, these companies rely on China to reach their economies of scale. If they lost half their unit sales, you can expect they'd be less than half as competitive, therefore, globally. Such an extreme move would mean the end of US dominance over the highest of high tech. Taken as a whole, American companies have around $400 billion at risk in China. Decoupling, as it's often called, would lower American GDP by an estimated 2%. Chinese companies, by comparison, only generate about a third as much revenue within the United States. The US-China relationship is really unlike any other. Inevitably, each will move toward greater independence. Already, some American companies are diversifying their supply chains. Huawei, ZTE, and officials in Hong Kong have likewise already been sanctioned. But however much leaders in each country may deny this fact, decoupling will be a slow and difficult process, and almost certainly never be complete. The most extreme form of sanctions would require a total trade blockade, which is itself an act of war. To seize China's foreign exchange, like the US did to Russia, would be no less unthinkable. Indeed, even Russia is granted exceptions to export fertilizer to the world and oil to Europe. There is, however, one trump card we haven't discussed. China controls access to the vast majority of what are called rare earth elements, the ingredients required to produce almost any piece of modern technology, from smartphones to F-35s. In 1992, Deng Xiaoping proclaimed, quote, "The Middle East has oil, China has rare earths." That's the subject of the new 17-minute third episode of our new Nebula original series, China Actually. Sign up now and you'll also get access to the first two episodes. The first is about how Chinese censorship actually works and why there are protests in China. The second is about the real reason China refuses to allow even a single case of coronavirus and why it likely won't fully open its borders anytime soon. Altogether, that's an hour of exclusive Polymatter content. You'll also get access to future videos in the series, plus you get ad-free and early access to all Polymatter videos, and other original series on Nebula, not to mention access to Curiosity Stream, home to great full-length documentaries on science, technology, and history. After I finish recording this video, for example, I'm going to watch this one about how container ships work. Get all that for just $15 a year right now with the Nebula and Curiosity Stream bundle. Click or tap the link on screen right now or in the description.